A trio of appointments were announced this week by government, with MHK's John Wannenberg and Tim Glover taking over as chairs of Manx Utilities and Office of Fair Trading respectively, if Tim will agree, and Rob Collister appointed as chair of planning. What does MUA chair-elect John Wannenberg think of his new role?
First of all, could I say that I'm really pleased to have been appointed to the role. It gives us a chance, well, gives me a chance to accept the challenge in what I think is going to be an exciting period for the MUA, in rolling out many ambitious goals. And not forgetting that the MUA touches every single household. It has an effect on every single person. And we must bear that in mind, that we are here for the many and not for the few. And as long as we can give a good service, a resilient service, and plan for the future, and I think that is our remit. You know, there's much more detail than that, obviously. But if I can lead and help change things where they need to be changed, then come be in.
So John, quoting Spock there, Tim, are you going to boldly go where no one has gone before in the OFT?
Well, I've spoken at length with Mr. Wannenberg on the topic, and they have a small team, but a good team from what I gather. Probably too much on their plate for what they're doing, but they...
I've briefed him very well.
Yeah, they do a very important role. I mean, we've only yesterday had the release about the rogue traders and do not answer your door to anyone who just turns up on spec. And these are important messages to get out. And I think as a statutory board, it's probably the one that's furthest removed from government and is seeking to do that even more. And I think it does need a little bit more teeth and able to do that as well.
And I suppose, I wasn't going to go straight in on this, but you've kind of queued me up. It wasn't that long ago that you said you didn't want to have anything more to do with government. You were alarmed, perhaps, at the way in which the Chief Minister was running his government. And yet here you are effectively taking on a government role.
And I'll wear that, but I think this is the furthest removed position that I could have accepted. I would not accept a department role, and my views on this current administration remain, as I said, 6 months or so ago.
OK, Rob, you're taking on chair of planning, and it's an interesting role because in a way it's more like a semi-judicial role rather than a political one, isn't it?
I think there's aspects of it which are very political, and I think we have to navigate a way around it. I'm looking forward to the new challenge after a very difficult year. I can't underline that fact. But I wanted to roll my sleeves up again. I wanted to get back into government. I wasn't quite ready to go back into a department just yet. So I thought this was the perfect opportunity to try something different, because as someone mentioned the other day, they sort of made the analogy that I'm trying to collect every single department. I'm trying to collect every single position within government, which is not my aim. But I am looking forward to meeting the six lay members that are on that, working with the board and trying to make sure we do apply the principles of public life and making sure the decisions we reach as a group are based on solid evidence and the best interest for the island.
Because there is some sense, isn't there, to having a chair of planning who doesn't sit in a department of government. I mean, in the past, we've had chairs of planning who have been in various departments, including at one time the DOI, which seemed a bit strange, bearing in mind DOI did most of the work in terms of planning applications. So you're being completely outside of any government role other than planning means that you do have the degree of independence that perhaps the chair of planning needs.
Well, I think we have to put that back in its context, Phil, because planning still comes under DEFA. It still comes under the remit of Mrs. Barber, which I'm happy to work with. But like David Ashford, it is dissolved a little bit from actual... I'm not a member of the department, which is what I wanted to be. So I followed the path that David Ashford had laid, and I think that's the correct procedure. The problem is, as well, we've got to remember that only 20% of planning applications actually go before the board. So we will need to make sure that the best decisions are being made on the Isle of Man for the people of the islands and for businesses as well, because we need businesses to grow. There's a lot of urban and brownfield sites that need to be developed, and we need to improve the overall look and feel of the island. And if I could do that as chair of planning, then I'll happily grasp that nettle and try and deal with it over the next 12, 18 months.
Certainly planning and the built environment have been very high on the list of this government's priorities, particularly, I feel you've all had an involvement in the creation of our island plan. Are you content with the general thrust and direction of planning policy and the suggested changes that Isle of Man government have in that plan? Maybe John to start there.
Well, I wasn't that long ago in this very studio and I told you that I think the way we communicate the plan and the way it's received by the public is not as good as it should be. And we've got some work to do on that. I mean, for instance, everybody will tell you that we need, the island plan has identified that we need 5,000 jobs, but nobody will tell you out there how we're going to do that. And I don't think I can honestly sit here and tell you how we're going to do it either. But do we need to do it? Absolutely, because without those people, without their tax receipts, you know, it's a vicious circle. We're not going to have the money for the schools, the roads, and the nursing care that we need. So I think we need to be more clear to the public on the island plan and how important it is for all of us, not just the government to show that we're delivering, but our futures depend on it, and it's got to be more than just a PR.
And certainly Douglas particularly, but maybe North Douglas to a lesser extent, there are quite a number of brownfield sites waiting for development. Are you convinced that things like the Manx Development Corporation that's been established and some of the changes that have already been introduced by government are going to result in the development of those brownfield sites?
Well, I know one thing, Phil, we have to try. And it is a controversial setup, Manx Development Corporation, as is the grants to those developers who are going to hopefully be building on those sites as well. But if we don't try, nothing will happen. And again, I'll refer to the Summerland site. You know, my sons have grown up here and have left the island. No Summerland, nothing else than as a bomb site. So it's right that we try and do something. And by the very nature that you try and do something, you're going to have the critics. So, yes, I think the MDC's got an important role to do. We need to make sure it's funded properly. We need to make sure that we have the right ambitions for it. And if we can get to what we're setting out, we're going to have the vibrant village. We're going to have all the things that go with it. And then when I say that, it's the dentists and the doctor's surgeries. Then, of course, that's something to be proud of. But we have to try, right?
Tim, planning, is that something that you're generally content with the overall direction? I mean, you spent some time in the Cabinet Office where some of the policies were being developed. Are you generally supportive, or have you concerns, or where are you at with planning?
Well, it's more the strategic side that Cabinet Office is responsible for rather than the actual making of decisions. So it is a different role, but just on what John was saying there, I agree that we've obviously got to try and make progress, but at the same time, and I think this is where government is failing at the moment, we've got to bear in mind the people that are already here and cater for them, which I don't think we are at the moment in terms of schools, in terms of waiting lists at the hospital, in terms of dentists. So we mustn't take our eye off that particular ball as well at the same time as trying to move things forward. We have to remember the people that are already here, and are we serving them satisfactorily? And I think if you go and talk to the people out there, the answer will come back pretty firmly no.
One of the reasons that the Freedom to Flourish idea withered quite dramatically was because there was this perception gap between what the people saw and what the overall message was going to be. Is that where you think we're at in terms of our island plan having that clear ambition and goal, And where the public actually feel they are at the moment? Or am I putting words into your mouth there? Possibly I am.
Yeah, I think you are. I mean, I was critical of the Ireland plan and in fact voted not for it. So I can speak. I don't think it's been communicated well. I totally agree with John Wallenberg there. I don't think the public understand it, have any comprehension of what it's about, and they will also tell you as well that nobody went in with a manifesto about growing the population. So where's that actually come from? I certainly didn't. I know John hadn't got that in his manifesto, and doubt Rob did either. So the public are not convinced, and they are dealing with the cost of living crisis and everything else that is firmly on their doorsteps at the moment, and they want to see things improve for them first rather than a rush to increase the population and put even more pressure on the services that are creaking already.
Okay, and Rob, I mean, in terms of planning policy, I mean, obviously you're not going to be devising policy, you're implementing policy, but are you generally content where government's going with planning policy? Do you have any concerns, or are you generally supportive of where we're going?
Well, as chairman, my sort of view is that my role is to ensure that business is properly dealt with and clear decisions are being reached. Obviously, the committee have loads of legislation it can fall upon, and that includes the Local Government Act 2016, the Building Control Act 1991, the Planning Committee Code of Conduct, and obviously the Interested Person Status as well, along with the Area Plan. And we know we've already got the Eastern Area Plan as well. So we've got a raft of legislation, guidance, frameworks and documents which the committee can call upon to make sure it is making those very clear and defined decisions on behalf of the, you know, on behalf of the applicant, but also on behalf of the island.
So clearly what you'll be dealing with on a day-to-day basis is much more mundane than the very grand and large proposals that many of us will see perhaps splashed across on the headlines of the papers and the radio. But all of these things matter, don't they? I mean, whether it's a relatively small planning application for an extension on a domestic property or a new factory or a large housing estate, they all matter to the people involved.
They do. Everybody, you know, if you're living next to a development, you know, which is not in keeping, then people have a right to object to it. I mean, I think we've got a very experienced planning committee. We've got a very good team. They're very experienced as well. They've built up a lot of knowledge over the years. You know, the committee, I don't know if the public actually understand this, but the committee also go out and look at sites. So it's not just a case of getting, you know, a ream of information from the public and from officers and then going through it and making a decision. They actually go out to the sites. They actually look at all of the mechanics that actually supports that application. I think from my point of view, I was also very fortunate because I was in DEFA for a couple of years in the last administration, and I had to go through several high profile appeals. And I thought that process has helped me immensely to take on the role of chairman of planning. And that's why when I was asked to take on the role, I thought, you know, I had the skills already to do that role.
And of course, the planning committee, as you, I think you pointed out earlier, assesses some of the planning applications. The vast majority of applications are assessed by officers.
Well,
and the vast majority are actually passed.
Well, some of them come under permitted development, you know, small building schemes and everything else. That has worked successfully, I think, for the island. You know, those small development schemes have actually been fine, so we're not clogging up the system. I think then a lot of the applications are reviewed by officers, and as I said, around 20% actually come before the committee, which I think is absolutely the right process. And what we do need to look at is maybe speeding up the process a little bit more, because people are waiting for applications to go through the process. Then you have the appeals process as well, which is absolutely the right process to have in respect of all applications. So it's about how we actually can speed it up a little bit. But then I think, as I think Charles Gard, you know, who produced an excellent video, highlights that the Douglas, for example, has 30 abandoned sites. Some of those have been developed, some of them are not. So in respect from a government point of view, do we need to put conditions on development? And that's not my role in planning. I'll just step away from now, just Rob Callis from MHK speaking. Does government need to put further conditions on planning in order to ensure that if someone applies for planning permission and they started, that it's completed within a timely manner in order to stop these half-built sites scattering our capital at the moment?
And at the moment, of course, you have a requirement that an application is commenced within a certain period of time, but there's no requirement for it to be completed.
No, they can just say, for example, put down the footings and then leave it. And I think we've got one in Strand Street, which has been highlighted by a number of members in Keys and in Tynwald, where it started and it stopped halfway through and people are walking past it. We need to get these developments, once they are approved, get them completed. And then, as you say, to tidy up our island, because it does have a knock-on effect about our tourism sector. And I will mention that in my speech in Tynwald later on this month.
Tim?
Yeah, I was just going to add to what Rob's saying. I mean, we've had so many occasions where plans have come forward for these brownfield sites in Douglas and then have evaporated into the wind again, and nothing happens for another couple of years before another proposal comes and exactly the same thing happens. So I think it is really important that we try and get these brownfield sites developed, but at the same time we have to have balance within it. And I do have a bit of a concern about the restricting that has happened in recent years of interested party status. And I think the whole process needs to be balanced, but have that push as well. So
can I ask what you mean by that, Tim? I'll tell you the reason why, because I think, you know, I've dealt with so many planning applications over the last 7 years. I think the interested party status now is very clear when it talks about a 20-metre boundary around the red line. I think it's absolutely clear then to everybody, because I have seen examples in the last administration where somebody living right next door to a development wasn't given interested party status because there was a road between their property ending and the property that was under development. That isn't right. It's very clear now with the 20-metre line around the property, and admittedly, where the, you know, there is sometimes you have a large development and only one property in the middle, so you know there is a little bit of confusion about where that 20 meter starts. But I feel the legislation and the guidelines are very clear, both to the applicant and both to people who may want to apply for interested parties.
They're a lot clearer than they were in the murky past, but I do think that sometimes a development will have an impact far greater on people than just 20 meters from the actual site.
I think you're right, and there is sometimes when it has a greater public input into it, and that is where government, you know, we're talking about you know, wind farms, we're talking about solar farms, you know, we're talking about huge housing estates. Sometimes there is a greater interest, and that is when government should step in and actually try to capture all of the public input in order to give a direction.
Yeah.
What the planning committee's role is to actually accept all of the accept all the information and then make a decision in the best interest of the island, you know, based on the clear evidence, taking into account the legislation and guidelines.
Agreed.
And of course, the planning committee is effectively independent of government. The whole purpose of it is to look at applications based on law, policy and regulation, rather than looking at it from a political perspective. And that effectively, Rob, is your role as chair to give a political perspective.
There is an item which may be coming in the future, which I think the government will have to make a decision for the whole island, and that's 5G. Because you cannot suddenly say, for example, have thousands of applications to put equipment on telegraph poles or lamp or street lights, and then suddenly find that some areas will turn them down, others will accept them. I think things like that, I've always said government should step in and make a national decision that the island is going to accept 5G, and we are going to actually bring through the legislation to do that. That takes the planning process out of the way. But again, they should take into account everybody's views when making that decision.
You're listening to Perspective with MHK's Rob Collister, John Wannenberg and Tim Glover. Let's move then over to the Office of Fair Trading. And John, maybe if you could start off by telling us a little bit about how the OFT works.
Yeah, well, it's a small team. And not only is it small, but it is under-resourced. And in the years gone by, prior to when it was sponsored by DEFA, it was a truly statutory board. It was independent. Since I've been there, and probably a while before that, it has been a sponsored department by DEFA. And we've lost, for instance, our drafting officers. They went off to the AG's chambers. So we have not a fractured team, but we have what we've got left. And I think there's been a concerted effort. I know that we are relocating within Slough Wallion down to the old forestry board. So we're trying to become autonomous now. And that's really important. Our lay members, Mike Bathgate, Les Wong and Barry Murphy, have been very helpful in pushing this agenda forward. And I think that's going to be important because the OFT needs to be truly independent. I don't need to tell anybody about the past year we've had with the gas provider. And the one thing I think we have been successful at has been resetting that relationship. Unfortunately, the gas provider has had billing issues, which are still not fully resolved. But we've had hundreds of complaints. Now, that's not the OFT's fault. But what I will take a measure of the OFT is how many of those complaints have we resolved successfully? And the answer is over 92%. Those people who don't come to the OFT to get their complaint resolved, that's not included in that. And there are far more than that. So I would urge everybody to come to the OFT and get their complaints resolved. By the very nature of what the OFT does, whether it's debt counselling, whether it's going out and checking on faulty conservatories, buildings and things like that, it's not something we would normally shout about. But you know, every week our people are going out to see household owners and people who are riddled with debt and trying to help them. And we do help them. But again, by the very nature of those complaints, it's not something we can stand up and shout about. But we absolutely provide an essential service at the OFT. And they need to be thankful for what they do. It's unsung.
Because, of course, we are going through a cost of living crisis. Whilst the political heat might have been turned down a bit on that, I'm guessing, and maybe you as chair of OFT can tell me, that for many people, the cost of living crisis is still a very significant problem.
It absolutely is. I'm not saying we are the only people who can help. I know the Salvation Army does that as well. What is worrying is that we're not seeing as many people as we think we should be. So what are they doing? Are they going to credit cards just trying to survive on their own, which is not the way to do it? They should come to us. We can help. The OFT is there to protect consumers, in whether it's buying faulty goods, whether it's checking hazardous materials, or whether it's trading standards. We are the last bastion of helping customers, and I wish that they would see us as being on their side. We don't have the powers we would like to have. That's not something we have to work within the framework we've got, and I think we have done really well. Going back to the billing issues, we did escalate that all the way up to the AG's office, and we went as far as we could. We couldn't go any further. Again, Tim's going to find out he can only shoot the arrows that he's got, and I think we have exercised all of our powers as much as we can. It's not enough. And we've seen the ShopRite acquisition by Tesco. It's clear to anybody that we should have been able to do something there, but we couldn't because the legislation's not in place.
I remember as a relatively fresh-faced MHK back in 2004, maybe 5, trying to bring forward a private members bill in relation to governing property purchases, and I was told at that time that the best place to do that would be through the OFT. However, the legislation needs to be upgraded quite significantly. Last time I looked, I don't think that significant upgrade had been done, and we're now about 18 years on from when I was told that.
It's the 1996 Fair Trading Act. That's what we've got, and it's hopelessly out of date. But as I said earlier on, we lost our drafting officer after the AG's chambers when we all merged into DEFA. So this whole piece of work of going to become autonomous, that's really important for the future. And we're well on the way, but we're not there yet.
And in terms of a new bill to significantly update fair trading legislation, is that on the cards at the moment? Or
it is on the cards, but I'll go back to this billing issue we had with the gas provider. There's a disproportionate amount of time that's been put on things which need to be fought straight away. So things like the Fair Trading Act, it gets pushed back because you're firefighting. But it's definitely after the acquisition of the supermarkets, then yeah, it's back on the program, definitely.
So Tim, sounds like you've got one or two challenges in this new role, assuming, of course, that Tim Mulds doesn't say, we're not having that Tim Glover fellow, we'll have
that could happen.
Else. It could, of course, yeah.
And I'm being very respectful of that. I mean, you know, there's you think when you get a potential appointment, you want to meet the people, but I think you have to be respectful of the process first. And I'm sure John's in a similar position with Manx Utilities. Until you're actually appointed, you can observe and shadow, if you like, and talk to the fellow, the current incumbent. But I think you have to be respectful of the process, and it has to be approved by Tim Wolfe first, and that's being respectful to Tim Wolfe.
Yeah, and the difference with Rob's role as chair of planning is that is a council of ministers appointment.
That's an appointment, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But I've spoken about many of the issues that John has just highlighted, and I go back to the amount of questions that came in when Tesco made its acquisition of Shoprite, and there was real concern amongst Timwell members about the fact that the secondary legislation wasn't in place with the Competitions Act. So, you know, that is something I think that we need to look at. And also, it was also clear during the Isle of Man Energy, Manx Gas as it was at the time when all this blew up, it was clear that the OFT didn't have, it could only work with what it's got.
Correct.
And maybe what it's got, it's been very effective in resolving individual issues, as John's already mentioned, but should the OFT really have had a little bit more power to be able to force the issue, particularly towards the company, I would guess, John?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's been well documented. It would be very different set of circumstances had we had those powers. And I've said it before, I don't believe we have a company that has the customer's point of view anywhere in its ethos. And I'm being very polite, so I'll stop.
It does seem quite strange, Rob Collister, that in an island situation where we know that through necessity, the island in many cases isn't big enough to have more than one operator in certain areas at least. It does seem strange that the quid pro quo, the other side of this is that we haven't got really good, strong regulatory frameworks in place.
I think we do need strong legislation. I think John eloquently outlined the concerns that's going on with the OFT, and when things like, sort of, say for example Tesco, we do need that competition bill to come through and to be brought into statute. We do need to give the OFT the powers it needs to actually to take on rogue builders or companies that are not fulfilling their customer charters. And let's be honest, there is companies on the island that have a very privileged position. And you could argue that with telecoms, you could argue that with utilities. And we have to get this right, because when costs increase and it has such an effect on an individual's household budget, then if something goes wrong or if the pricing seems excessively high compared to our counterparts in the UK, then I think it's absolutely right that these things are investigated. But when there's no point doing an investigation, making some recommendations, but have no teeth to deal with them. And I think one thing I think we'll take away from this programme is I think all three of us need to actually look and see what powers the OFT does require in order to give them the teeth in order to deal with these situations in the future.
I think it was encouraging that the Chief Minister did say in Timwell that it wasn't immediately high up at the moment in the statutory programme, but if members felt that it was a higher priority than it currently is, that would be, should be looked at. So I think it's up to Timwell members to really push for that, and hopefully that support will come.
And you'll be leading the charge, assuming.
I think it's really important that the OFT does have a stronger presence, and it is on the side of the consumer, and that sort of gets overlooked at times. It's on the side of the consumer.
It definitely is, and it takes a kicking at times when it doesn't. It shouldn't have to take a kicking because they are fighting the battles.
In certain cases.
Yeah.
I think the other point is, though, I think all three of these positions, you know, we are pretty much the public face, and they can come under immense criticism at times. And I think we saw that quite heavily in the last administration. What we do need is to make sure when there is criticism, if it's fair, that we take it on board mm-hmm. and we deal with it. But when it's unfair, that, you know, colleagues and even the Council of Ministers actually get behind the three chairs and actually support them. Because as you clearly said, and I think John's done an amazing job as the OFT chair, and it's, you know, especially dealing with utilities. But sometimes you can clearly see John's frustration because he's actually doing everything he can as the chair, but he hasn't got the support behind him. And we need to listen to that and give him the support. And it's the same could be applied to Manx Utilities, because I know when I was the chair there, we went through a real difficult period around utility costs, you know, having to the price of natural gas. And I am a little bit concerned going towards the end of this year, going into next year, especially during the winter period, that we may have another spike in utility costs. And it's going to be very difficult for the chair to stand up publicly to explain those costs. And we do need to support him. And I will do my best to support John, you know, if he does have to come forward and explain an increase in the tariffs, because the global price of natural gas has increased again over the winter period.
Part of the problem that I think we've been identifying as we've gone through the programme so far is there's a lack of resource in OFT, there's a lack of resource in planning. Government sets all these wonderful policies and decides, yes, we'll do this, we'll do that, we'll do the other. But sometimes these areas where, you know, if you're going to introduce new policies, you're going to properly scrutinise commerce on the Isle of Man, you actually need to have resource available. At the same time as recognising this, we also recognise that this year government's working on a £150 million deficit. So where does the shift come here?
There's a comment that came very early in this 5-year period, and it was from Mr. Speaker, and he said it's all very well having all these ambitious plans and to bring various bits of legislation that will back up those plans that were coming forward. He did warn that you will go nowhere if you haven't got sufficient drafters for that legislation, and that keeps ringing alarm bells with me. And we're seeing here that the OFT needs beefing up a little bit in terms of the legislation, but we have that still shortage of drafters to actually bring that forward. And I think that's evident by the number of bills that haven't come into Tynwald and the House of Keys and the Legislative Council in the first 2 years of this administration.
The result of it is that when a company like this gas provider, who implements the billing system that they have done, which has had catastrophic results on people's finances, driving them into debt, and there's nothing we can do about it, and we sit back and we think, well, what should we be doing? And then when we think this is what we should be doing, but no, we can't do it because the legislation's not in place, then whose fault is that? That's our fault, right? And we have to push it forward. And again, legislation, as you know, Phil, takes years. And in the meantime, every month, people are finding it difficult.
But it's taking even longer at the moment, isn't it? Because we haven't got the resource of drafters there.
Absolutely. And again, you know, what we are pushing through at OFT at the moment is that we're waiting to become responsible for the vaping. Right now, this will stand alongside the tobaccos, but again, it's another little straw we put on the OFT's back, and it's just another thing we've got to do. And eventually, you know, it's going to break the back.
One option, of course, available to all departments is outsourcing drafting. I remember both Ewan Watterson, Speaker of the House of Keys, and myself, when I was still a minister, we did that, and all of a sudden legislative drafting became more of a priority because they didn't really want outside people doing the drafting. Maybe that's another option. Rob, I know you've been trying to
come back on two points. I think we need to start prioritising legislation. I think, you know, removing the bishop's vote, for example, that's going to take up drafters' time. It's a piece of legislation that's not high in the priority. When we looked, if there was a choice between removing the bishop's vote or giving the OFT, the TIEF, to do its job, then, you know, we all, I think even the public, will understand the, what would take priority there. I do want to step back just to something you said, because I don't think, from what I've seen initially, that planning is lacking resources. We have staff that are incredibly working very hard under pressure. And what we need to do is to streamline the system. The sort of developments that don't need to come to planning has worked incredibly well. So we need to look and see what else we can do to make the whole process far quicker, far more robust. But we also need to take some of the pressure off the officers. So I don't think, from what I've seen, it is you know, a lack of resources. I think the resources there, we just need to manage how we actually deliver the service.
Planning enforcement, is that well resourced?
Well, I think it is, but I will speak to officers just to get a lot more detail on that. But it takes up time. When you're having to deal with enforcement, it's not just a quick conversation. A lot of the time it goes into many months. So I need to speak to office. I need to understand exactly. But I've got to remember what my role is. My role is the chair of the planning. It is to go through applications. It is to make very clear decisions and to support the team and making sure that we actually do the very best job we can as a committee.
You're known in Tynwald for trying out a number of roles. Maybe the chair of planning will be one that you actually like and stick with.
I've got to come back to that. I'm sorry, I've got to come back to that. I worked in DfE for 6 years. I worked in five government departments in total. I've enjoyed every single role off them. I've not gone in and come straight back out, unlike somebody who's sitting to my right. You know, I have actually committed myself to every role I've done. Unfortunately, the only one that got seriously derailed was the role of being a minister, and we can park that. But any other role I've had, I've been very successful and worked within the government departments.
One of the roles, then, that you have been comfortable in was chair of the MUA. What's John Wannenberg letting himself in for here?
As I've said, I think, myself personally, I think the role that gave me the most sleepless nights was the chair of Manx Utilities. It has a fantastic organisation, a great workforce, got a great executive team, great board that will support the new chairman. But politically, I found some of the decisions being made politically were very, very difficult. And it did give me sleepless nights, you know, this time last year. And it's just one of those roles that, you know, it affects everybody. You know, there's 40,000 domestic customers. You know, there's 8,000 businesses looking at you. And then you've got your water, your sewerage as well, on top of your electricity. I think John is the right person. I think he's, you know, got the skills that he needed to being the chair of OFT to take on that public facing role. But I think John will also experience new challenges over the coming weeks and months, especially during the winter period when we start to look at utility costs, and especially if we start to see a spike in the natural gas price, especially in December and January.
John?
Because of course the role there the role of the MUA is to provide not just power, which is sort of well known, but also water, and these are two of the most essential elements for life.
I think there is some big decisions to be made. John already highlighted them. You know, connecting the people of Garth to the sewerage works is one. Connecting Peel, that looks relatively straightforward. Then you've talked about, you know, the organisation having to transition from fossil fuels to natural, sort of greener, more initiatives. They are going to be very, very difficult conversations. What John needs is the full support with the Council of Ministers behind them when the board starts to look at those very difficult decisions on behalf of the people of the island.
John, no pressure?
No, exciting times, Phil. I like a bit of cut and thrust, and let's get on with it. You know, we are here to do things as politicians, and I'm going to do my very best to make sure that we drive the agenda forward. There's too many important things to happen for us to stand around and do nothing. And, you know, I fully realise that those things which Robert said, some of them were going to be very hard. It wasn't easy standing up during the billing issues with Island Energy. This will be a different kettle of fish, but I believe that I'm, you know, I believe I can do it. I wouldn't have taken a job if I thought I couldn't do it. Yes, it's going to be difficult, but it's also going to be very exciting.
And, I mean, you mentioned there Island Energy. Island Energy is a customer of the MUA. How is that relationship going to work?
I have my thoughts on that company, and they're completely unchanged, as I sit here with you now.
Okay. Tim, you're famously, and I should at this stage declare that I have an interest in the wind farm that the MUA is developing, but you and your colleague in Arbury, Castletown and Maloo have been fairly vocal in relation to that particular MUA proposal. Do you, any particular concerns about the new chair, or do you think he's going to do a good job for the people of the island?
I think we'll have a few questions and some debates on issues, I'm sure. But I do know that John's a man of principle.
Thank
and
you.
John will want things to be done with proper due process and principle.
Of course.
And
well, what I would say
you
is that
respect that then. But as I've got to represent the constituents.
I'd expect that's part of a role
of an MHK. So we will have some, but you know, it'll be respectful.
Well, it'll always be respectful. Never pay the man. But what I would say is that, as I said earlier at the beginning of this interview, is that we are here, MUA, to touch everyone's life, and I can't be governed by just a few. We've got to do the thing for the collective good for the whole island, and that's what I'm going to do, irrespective of the collateral damage I may take.
What else has been happening politically that tickles your fancy?
It'll be interesting to see what is on the agenda for Tynwald this month, because obviously we've got work permits, and you know, I have a very comprehensive speech ready to go on work permits if the item is not removed before the sitting. I think it's absolutely right that we fight.
Should it be removed?
Yes, absolutely. We've had that legislation in place since 1952. We need to protect our working population. This isn't about Manx people. This is about protecting our working population. I will provide very clear evidence in my speech that shows that the Isle of Man's population is growing naturally, as it always has done since 1952. We do not need to remove work permits. We've obviously got the report from Ofsted as well into children's social care, and we attended a presentation yesterday, which I thought was very, very, very helpful to members. Again, I'm going to be highlighting the institutional failings by this government in respect of children's services and how we have to improve. You know, there's only a handful of children leaving care each year. I cannot believe that this government does not wrap themselves around those children, those young adults, to give them the perfect start as adults. So there's just two items that I'm really seriously looking forward to in this month's Tynwald sitting.
And you've also been very outspoken in relation to Laurie Hooper's motion to introduce a bill.
It's not high. If you speak to the people of the Isle of Man, most of them would actually say this is not the high priority. And when we're short of legal drafters, we need to prioritise our legislation drafting. And I just think the minister's completely wrong on this.
And that's in relation to the bishop. And of course,
and the bishop's vote, yeah.
In relation to that, he's not acting as the minister, he's acting as a member, a constituent.
But he is still the minister for the health and social care role. And if you speak to the people of this island, they would actually say they want him to focus on his day job and not, you know, as I said in the House of Keys, navel gazing, you know, around the bishop's vote.
Tim.
Yeah, work permits is one I completely agree. I think we've got very much the same stance on this. And I go back to looking after the people that we've already got here first. And that's a focus I think we need to remember. We're trying to make progress, but we've still at the same time got to look after who we've got here, and work permits is very much part of that.
Were there a minister here for DfE, he would probably say, well, look, work permits is largely a comfort blanket now. It doesn't serve any particular purpose.
So then why
would you keep it, I think it would be his argument.
It's hardly an inconvenience anyway in the first place. Most work permits are done within 24 hours.
I've put it in my speech that it is a comfort blanket. It is a protection for our working population. Yes, we know that certain things can be manipulated to get the right person for the role. moral, but at the end of the day, it makes employers fully aware of the Manx people. If you've got two people equal, then why not give it to the Manx person? Give them the promotion, give them the opportunity. If they cannot fill the role, then go out further to bring somebody into the island. That, to me, it is really that simple. It's the minister's wrong on this one.
And to be honest, I think it's slightly gesture politics on behalf of the minister there. If you dig into it and look into it strategically, we have got so many people that aren't working at the moment because they can't afford to. People who are carers or people who are parents looking to get back in. We've got to look at things to try and get those people that aren't working on the island into work. And that is way bigger issues like housing and social care. That's where we should be focusing.
Absolutely.
John Wannenberg, the minister, minister for DfE, has a certain responsibility to listen to what people in business are telling him. And he says, and there seems to be evidence to back this up, that they're telling him work permit legislation is a hindrance to recruiting people.
He has as big a responsibility to listen to the people who have elected him and to his colleagues in the House. And I would argue that he should not move the work permits. Leave them as they are. And I've said that in the last program as when we were here. Concentrate, as Tim says, on the bigger stuff, right? We're sweating the small stuff. Let's get the big things done.
Okay, and in terms of big things, where are your political attentions going to be drawn over the forthcoming 10 months?
Specifically what, Phil?
Well, I don't know. You just said we need to focus on the big issues, and I'm asking what they might be in relation to your political priorities.
What I would say in the last week, the last month, we've all been talking about a sister dying. And that's taken an inordinate amount of time for everybody and will have huge ramifications again on drafters. But what I would say, my own personal view on a sister dying, is freedom of choice is paramount. And as important as freedom of choice is the robust rights safeguards. And if the safeguards aren't in place, then I'm going to vote not to go for it, because those safeguards are absolutely essential to be right. And that's why I supported Rob Hallister's amendment to form a committee. But equally, if it's not right, I'm not voting for it. It has to be right.
And there's a concern as well that Rob's brought up, and you've just mentioned the assisted dying. The bishop's vote and the assisted dying particularly are going to dominate the next remaining time that we've got over the next 5 years, when there's really, you know, big issues and improvements that we're looking and striving to make. But what's going to get the headlines?
Well, one, though, maybe challenging that a little bit, one of the things that previous administrations who have been successful in turning things round was that they actually did undertake constitutional reform. So back in the early 90s, the Council of Ministers Act was put into place, and that led to the very significant reforms and changes that were necessary to allow for an improvement in economic circumstance. So perhaps some constitutional reform is necessary to help the move the system on.
But we only talked about it 3 months previously. It was opportunistic.
I think you're right, and that to me is the main thing here. We've got to start delivering parts of the island plan. I've said that all the way, especially on housing, you know, improving people's lives on the island, man, sorting out our health service. If you just speak to the people in the streets, you know, we all should just go down to Strand Street one lunchtime and speak to people. They will tell you they're more concerned about getting a doctor's appointment. 4,200 people waiting for a dentist, over 9,000 people waiting for a first referral just to see a consultant. And then we have people accessing housing. Rental prices, you cannot buy a property on the island for less than £1,000. How can you afford that rent when you're earning the minimum wage of about £23,000 a year? These are all the questions that this government should be focused on. We are focusing on too many little things instead of raising the bar a little bit.
Sideshows.
John, final word?
Merry Christmas.
That was MHK's Rob Collister, John Wannenberg and Tim Glover. What do you think? Does OFT have enough power and resource to protect consumers? Is planning fit for purpose, and will government's planning reform agenda deliver? Will your electricity bills be safe in John Wonenberg's hands? Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com, and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Gunnar Myers and Geisha Krum. Thanks for listening.